Hello, welcome to episode 135, or Tea or Books. I'm Simon.
I'm Rachel.
And this is a podcast where we debate the difficult decisions of books and reading. In this episode, we talk about, can literary fiction be a comfort read? And in the second half, we do Enter Ghost by Isabella Hammad and Lady Living Alone by Nora Lofts. You may remember, if you listened to our last episode, that they were both in our respective top 10 reads for last year, and we each chose one book from the other's favourite reads of last year to see if we've enjoyed them. So we don't know yet what the other one thought. We will find out in the second half, and we'll explain more about that first half, which was a suggestion from Marcy. Thank you, Marcy, in a moment. But first, Rachel, happy February, and what are you reading?
Yeah, thank goodness. January is over. I'm all right, thank you. And I am currently about halfway through a book called Julia by Sandra Newman, which is a retelling of 1984 by George Orwell, but from Julia's perspective, who is the female character, and who, you know, is very much a secondary character in the original novel. It's a bit of an interesting one, really, because I wouldn't say that I'm loving it in terms of, like, I'm not excited to get to it, and I'm actually taking me quite a long time to read it because of that. But when I do read it, it's perfectly well written, it's compelling. And I was looking forward to talking to you about it, actually, because I think it's interesting when you read books like this that are a retelling or a reimagining or a revisioning or whatever you want to call it of an existing novel that you know very well. And the author's following the same plot points. It can feel quite difficult to feel excited because you know what's coming.
Yeah.
So I think that's what I'm struggling with it. It's a story that's new, but it's also not at the same time. I don't know if you've read anything like that.
Oh, that's interesting. I'm trying to think. It's not the same. I sometimes find that with TV adaptations, if they're just very, very by the book, which, you know, is adaptations probably should be faithful. But sometimes I think I do just know what's going to happen. And this is basically just a very, very faithful retelling of the novel. But I'm trying to think. I've not read many retellings. And the things that come to mind, if, you know, like Bridget Jones being a retelling of Pride and Prejudice or something, are so different that it's not really the same. But yeah, I can imagine. This is not the same, but I found that really frustrating in Five Little Pigs by Agatha Christie, which is many regard as one of her best books, but it basically goes through the same story five times from different perspectives, and that, again, it's within the same novel, but it had that same issue that I just found it so tedious, because it was, yeah, I know what's going to happen, obviously a little twist each time, but it's just the same plot points over and again, and I really don't like repetition. That's something I really, in songs or in books or in poetry, I find repetition hard. So
it's a tough one, because I mean I want to enjoy it on its own merits, but I just feel a little bit like, well, you know, I've read this book before, but in a slightly different, it's like through a kaleidoscope almost. It's also one of those books that it's taken a good third of the way through to get interesting, and I'm like, you've really tested my patience up to this point. So anyway,
okay,
next time. But everyone else seems to have loved it, and it's had excellent reviews. So maybe it's just that January feeling where everything feels a bit of a struggle that has affected my reading experience. I don't know.
Well, a while ago, it was the Audible deal of the day, and I was tempted, and I put on social media, like, has anyone read this? Would I enjoy it? And actually, it got a relatively lukewarm response from the people who responded to me. So maybe it's one of these ones which actual readers I don't like as much as critics. I don't know.
Yes, people paid to give an opinion, yes.
Yes.
How are you? Clearly still struggling with the January cold that everyone's having.
Oh, yes. Well, to our dear listeners, I will have cut out all these coughings. So they will have no idea that it's happening. But yes, the lingering effects of a cold. But I'm currently reading a book I'm really enjoying. And also, I've seldom been more confident that you would love a book. So I really want to recommend to you, if you've not already read it, Catherine Carter by Pamela Hansford-Johnson. Are you familiar?
No.
Yeah. So I've read a few books by her over the years, and this one feels very different from the others. The others are often quite sort of detached and a bit spiky, maybe, and occasionally gruesome, whereas this is, it's written in 1952, but set in 1880s London theatre scene. And Catherine Carter is a young sort of ingenue actor actually not super ingenue. I think she's 25 or something, but she joins this company as, you know, playing maids and things. And the actor manager, who I thought was quite old until I got to a point where he's just revealed he's 39, which is my age. So he's a young man, but older than her. And I can tell at some point they're going to fall in love, which they have not done yet. But I don't know, it's a quite long book. It's about 460 pages, and I'm about 200 pages in. And it's really just an examination of 1880s theatre. And they, which reminds me a bit of Enter Ghost, they're playing Shakespeare. They do Much Ado About Nothing. They've done Othello. And it really goes through different analyses of the different parts and how people play them and how those dynamics affect the actors off stage as well. And it's quite a gradual, comforting, warm sort of book, but really, you know, sometimes you can feel the author really loves the characters. Mm. And that really comes across. It's very immersive. And yeah, I mean, who knows how authentic a portrayal of 1880s theatre it is, being published 70 years after that. But I really love it much more than I've liked her other books, actually. And I keep reading it thinking, I'm pretty sure Rachel would love this too.
Oh, well, that sounds very exciting.
Yeah, and my copy is signed by her, which is either lovely.
Oh, well done.
Yeah, it was a gift from somebody, gosh, 7-8 years ago probably, and I'm finally getting to it. But yeah, I was put off a bit because it is quite long. You know, I don't leap towards long books, but it's exactly the sort of sumptuous read I'm happy just to relax into.
Well, sounds lovely. Perfect January. Yeah.
Yes, and the link nicely to the first question, can literary fiction be comfort reads? And I'll just read some of the email that Marcy sent us. Let's see, she wrote lots of lovely things. I read all of them. She said, because these aren't the easiest of times, I'm craving comforting fairy tale books with happy endings that are well written and intelligent. And as you can imagine, that is not an easy combination to find. And yet I'm sure many people want something exactly like that as well right now. I'm thinking Enchanted April or Jane Garden books or even Virginia Woolf's Diaries, rather misread twee type of books, as I believe you call them. I did call them that, you're right, Marcy. And then she said, I know it needs to be put as an XYZ question. Yes, it does, Marcy. Well done. I've taken that and sort of retwisted it a bit into can literary fiction be comfort reads? And hopefully you'll come up with some suggestions along the way. And it's, you know, similar to, we've talked about reading deeply or shallowly quite recently. A couple of years ago, we talked about comfort zones. But I think this is something a bit different. We're not just talking about like well-written, enjoyable books like, P.G. Woodhouse or something is really lovely and comforting and fun to read, but probably not literary fiction. But are they opposites? Do they overlap? Where to start? Well, maybe we should talk about whether we have comfort reading in general and then see if literary fiction fits in.
Yeah, I mean, well, I think what's important, first of all, is to define what we mean by comfort when it comes to reading. And I think for a lot of people, that will be something quite different. I think, you know, comfort can look like a happy ending for some, you know, that can be one way of defining it. But a lot of comfort reads, as some people find, for example, Agatha Christie or crime novels, comfort reads, police procedurals, and they often don't have particularly happy endings and involve people dying.
So that's true.
I think it's everybody's got, finds comfort in different ways. And I think comfort also is, for some readers, about rest for the mind, whereas others is just being in a world that feels familiar, for example. Like, you know, if you want comfort reading, you don't want to read a book where you're going to have to do any research or anything like that. So I think if I'm thinking about comfort for me, like when I think, oh, I really need comfort reading, it's probably something familiar, something where I know I'm exactly what I'm going to get. So that for me might be a reread, or it might be a book by an author I really know and I haven't read that book by them yet, but I know what to expect from them because all their other novels are fairly similar. And that would be most often the kind of book I would head for if it was a comfort read. It's or sometimes, well, actually, no, I mean, rarely I would read a children's classic that I loved when I was a child, but I tend to not to do that because I find it's always disappointing when you get back to a book you loved as a child and you realise, It's perhaps not quite as you remembered it, or not quite as...
Everyone's much more racist than you realise at the time.
Oh, God, this is what I was reading as a child. It's a miracle I'm a half-decent human being. So I think it's interesting to think about those different definitions and to think about why we, you know, what we individually define as comfort reading and perhaps what that says about us as readers. But so for me, for example, I mean, my favourite comfort read would be to read Emma.
I was going to say, get that klaxon ready, everyone. Take your bingo box, have a drink, whatever you're doing.
I've got to get it in. And I love that book so much, and it's so familiar, and it's just a wonderful story for me to sink into. I find something new in it every time. But for another person, they would be like, oh gosh, you know, it's so wordy, it's so complex, I'm not, and it's so long, you know, how can that be a comfort read? So it's I'm not sure whether it would be on everybody's list of comfort reads, but for me it's perfect.
Yeah, I'm glad you said familiarity earlier, because I was thinking that similarly, or even dependability is the thing I'm looking for most in a comfort read. And like you said, that might be rereading. My go-to would be, and you can have a drink for this one, everyone as well, Diary of a Provincial Lady, or any of that series. But similarly, dependability could be an author that I know exactly what they're going to do, like a P.G. Woodhouse or an Agatha Christie. I know what I'm getting. I don't think I'd ever go to an author I hadn't read before as a comfort read, even if it looked like the sort of thing that would be fun and comforting in other ways, and, you know, happy ending, all that sort of thing, because I wouldn't want the unpredictability. I think the times when you really want comfort is when the world, whether, you know, at large or personal things, feels unstable, and you're looking for that stability to offset that, in my experience at least. So I'm trying to think what other definitions I would put in. I don't think the happiness or otherwise of the characters particularly matters to me in terms of comfort, because I might turn to a Marjorie Sharp or something, where often the characters are sort of being mocked by her, or an Ivy Compton Burnett, I mean, at a stretch, where no one's having a good time, but because I know the sort of authors they are. And I say that actually I might push that definition of dependability to a publisher I'm very familiar with, like, you know, a Furrow Middlebrow book or maybe a Persephone book, if I'm thinking I might not know this author, but I know I can rely on it being good quality and fun and not too haunting. Whereas, yeah, as you say, there are some people who go to a Val McDermott or something for a comfort read, which certainly I never would. Or those people, it's like those people who watch documentaries about serial killers to wind down of an evening. Not for me.
I feel like at night imagining someone at my door.
But would quality of writing play into what comforts you or not when you're looking for a comfort read?
Well, listen, I mean, I can't read anything that's crappily written. I physically can't do it. So when it's something that is quote unquote, you know, comfort, relaxing, even twee, if we want to call it that, it still has to be well written, beautifully written. It still has to be able to kind of hold my attention in that way. I can't read books that are badly written. Every word just annoys me to the point. I mean, that would not be comfortable for me at all. So for example, like my favorite books that would probably fall into that category of, you know, the hot water bottle reading or something where you can sort of switch your mind off a bit would be Miss Read books. I love Miss Read books, but I still think that they are beautifully written. They're very well constructed books, and they are full of beautiful description, and I kind of don't necessarily switch my brain off when I read them. It's just they've got that dependable quality where, you know, nothing bad's going to happen. Well, some bad stuff does happen to people, but it's never, you know, I'm not going to finish the book feeling depressed. You know, I like to have that sort of uplifting feeling. But I have tried reading books that have been in that sort of genre, and I couldn't get past the first page because they were so poorly written.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that the stakes for a character, whether they're high or low, sometimes is different internally and externally. I.e., in a misread novel, someone might have something horrible happen to them, but for some reason, the stakes don't feel that high to you as a reader because of the way it's written and the tone of the novel. Similarly, like an Agatha Christie novel, as you say, people get murdered, but the stakes feel low outside the novel because you don't really care about the person who's got murdered. Whereas, you know, you might get like a Catherine Mansfield short story where the stakes look really low, like someone's criticized a lady's fox fur. But externally, it's devastating because of the way she writes it and the way she makes it devastating. So, yeah, I think, I want the stakes to be low when I'm reading a comfort read, but that might not be feel low to the characters, if that makes sense.
Yes, and I think that's something that's really important to think about, because there are some books that I absolutely love and will revisit again and again, but I find them so emotionally, you know, involving that I certainly couldn't read them if I were in a vulnerable state of mind myself and just needed to lie on the sofa and feel comforted. You know, like something like The Remains of the Day is the most wonderful book.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, I'm just an absolute mess by the end of it and need to lie down for a while. So it's just, you know, I would never go to something like that. Whereas, you know, a misread book where I know, you know, somebody's going to have a terrible time, but I also know that, you know, it will be okay because, you know, that's all part of life and the village will gather round and in the end, you know, there'll be some sort of rosy way of moving forward. It's absolutely fine. But even it with something like, you know, like a Dorothy Whipple novel, which has been refused to be published by Virago Press famously because it's not considered true enough, which, you know, I entirely disagree with. Her books are what some people might deem to be comfort reading, but actually some of them do involve very distressing personal circumstances where, you know, women are being cheated on by their partners or left by their partners and left with no money. So as much as we might consider domestic fiction to be that kind of cozy read, actually I think a lot of these very well written and very I suppose realistic mid-century writers who were very much writing for women and writing for the kind of reality of their lives, I think it's a mistake to kind of dismiss them as being merely comfort reading, because the focus on women's lives doesn't mean it's going to be an easy read. I mean, that's a kind of, I suppose, the problem with considering women's lives to be in a domestic setting to be entirely uncomplicated. But there we are.
Yeah, I think it's a really good point, because a lot of the times when people want to comfort read, it is because of something that is happening to them in the domestic sphere, whatever that might be. And so even mention of, you know, a character who's just been diagnosed with an illness, or a character who's been cheated on, or a character who's in debt, or whatever the actual issue the reader is facing, if that comes up, it's just de facto not going to be a comfort read.
Yeah,
I mean, I found that years ago with a film when I was like, I need to distract myself because I was really worried about my cat. And then there's someone that's like, the cat gets an illness in this film, which is otherwise meant to be this, like, you know, very distracting thing. It's like, well, no, that chimes too close to home, which is what domestic fiction does so well, of course. The sort of chiming close to home is what makes them so powerful so often, but for not comforting. I'm intrigued by the books that Marcy suggests as comfort reads. I'll just mention them again. So Enchanted April, I can see that why that one would be, because she writes beautifully, it's in a beautiful setting, the stakes feel quite low. I mean, there's lots of arguments, but you sort of know everyone's going to get on. Jane Gardam, I enjoy her writing, but the ones I've read I wouldn't think of particularly comforting. And then Virginia Woolf's Diaries fascinates me as a comfort read, because I love Virginia Woolf's Diaries, but they're often miserable and quite distressing. So I'm interested, Marcy, in those choices. But I know you've read all of those as well, Rebecca. Would you? Rebecca, Rachel, how do I forget your name? It's long after we've been in the podcast. Rachel, you've read them.
I don't know what it is. I think it's, you what know, your name begins with R.
So sorry, appalling. Rachel, you've read all of those. Would you consider them, or any of them, comfort reads?
I mean, The Enchanted April, certainly. I would say probably it's one of Elizabeth von Arnim's most uncomplicated books, in the sense of, you know, there being quite a straightforwardly happy ending. I certainly wouldn't consider Virginia Woolf's Diary as a comfort read for me personally. I think anything by Virginia Woolf, I find her writing to be so dense that it requires actually quite a lot of that for me, a comfort read is something that I don't have to do too much thinking about. And it's like a restful experience. And reading nonfiction for me is never a restful experience. And I suppose for me as well, so many of Virginia Woolf's diaries, or whether you're reading them in their entirety, I mean, not that it is their entirety, but, you know, the actual volumes of her diary as published, you're reading a kind of a compendium or sort of contraction in the writer's diary or whatever that whatever kind of form you've got it, it's informational. There's a lot of detail in there. There's references to people's names that you might have to look up and so on and so forth. And, you know, so for me, no, that wouldn't work. And also hanging over it all is the knowledge of how it all ends. And that's always a bit of a, there's always a note of sadness in it, which I think is not what I would be looking for in a time of comfort. What was the other one that she mentioned?
Well, she said Jane Gardam, didn't mention which particular ones by Jane Gardam.
Yes, I mean, I love Jane Gardam's novels, and her Old Filth series in particular I think is absolutely brilliant. But no, I'm not sure I call them comfort reads. I mean, they're quite, I suppose, thought-provoking, challenging in the way that they look at life and question the purpose of life, and you know, make you, that I actually think they make you reflect a lot on your own choices. And I think when you're in a time where maybe your things are feeling a little bit turbulent and out of your control, you don't necessarily want to be having to, you know, think about, well, God, you know, yes, maybe I haven't been very nice to people or whatever. It's like, yes, I'm not sure that I would, they would be my choices. But then that goes back to what I said at the beginning, you know, that comfort reading is very much a definition that each individual has to make for themselves. Mm-hmm. Look for something very different at times of crisis in our lives.
And of course, the definition of literary fiction will be different for different people, yes, as well. Because I was trying to think what might qualify for that. And what you were saying about you don't think too much for a comfort read, I think literary fiction, I would sometimes classify as that if it's very formally experimental or experimental in different ways. And that's really not what I want when I'm after a comfort read. So I definitely wouldn't want something that, you know, does something unusual with punctuation. I mean, I probably wouldn't under any circumstances, but yeah, the sort of, or the sort of, you know, Mark Danielowski's, is that his name, The House of Leaves, that sort of very over the top postmodern fiction, I definitely wouldn't, I think anything postmodern I wouldn't really want as comfort fiction. I just want a novel to be a novel in that case. But something like Virginia Woolf, I think I probably could find her fiction comfort read just because it's familiar. I don't think I would have found it comfort read the first time around. But something like To the Lighthouse, where I think I can just relax into how beautiful this writing is and sort of just let it wash over me and not worry too much about what's going on. That could work. Or The Waves, particularly similarly. I remember even the first time I read that, I just remember thinking these sentences are beautiful. It was more like just the sort of sensual experience, I guess, rather than taking on the plot or the characters. It was more just I'm just going to enjoy someone doing beautiful things with language. And I know people, for that reason, I don't, but some people find poetry the ultimate comfort read just because it's beautiful and they don't have to worry too much about content. They can just enjoy the beauty of it. Not that poetry doesn't have content, of course, but you can choose which parts you're going to enjoy at different times. Mm. So if it's someone who just writes really beautifully and that's why it's literary fiction, I think I probably could. But I mean, I'm also really struggling to define literary fiction because whilst I love Elizabeth von Arnim, I don't know if I'd call The Enchanted April literary fiction. But I don't know why I'd say that. It's very well written and it's very good. So maybe it is literary fiction.
Yeah, I don't know. Well, I mean, it's difficult to define, isn't it?
Mm.
I think there's a, with literary fiction, there's a sense of there's something almost sort of academic about it, something of a higher level of cerebral quality. And I'm not sure that Elizabeth von Arnim would qualify for that, but I do also think her writing is very beautiful and I don't see why not. So yeah, I guess it's a virago classic, isn't it? So I think once you slap the word classic on it, it can slip itself into that category, can't it?
Yeah, true. Yeah. Well, maybe before we come to our decision making thing, we can come up with some suggestions for books that Marcy can actually read, because that's probably what she's after rather than our abstract discussing. Sorry, Marcy, but I'll give you some thinking time whilst I say some. But I think books that I would suggest based on what you said, and listeners to the podcast will have heard these, but Hostages to Fortune by Elizabeth Cambridge would be a lovely one for that. It's about, it's a Persephone book about this family in Oxfordshire, a doctor's wife and her children. And again, the stakes are relatively low, but it's a really full, immersive life. That's a good example of something really well written, but I think quite comforting. And I mentioned that the last podcast, it was my favourite book of the year. It was Catherine Dunning's The Spring Begins. And again, it's not available yet, but I've just been writing the afterword today, which is why it's top of mind. And I believe is pre-orderable from Blackwell's, if you want to do that, anyone. And I think I meant to say other bookshops are available, but Blackwell's is the one that does free international shipping. So go and pre-order it. But that's, again, really beautifully written about the lives of three members of, I guess, broadly the serving classes. And yeah, again, the stakes are not low for the characters, but they feel relatively low as we're reading them, because I'm not sure that's true, but I found it comforting just because it's so immersive. And in fact, Catherine Carter by Pamela Hansford Johnson, just to go back to the beginning of the episode, I'm finding that very comforting and very well written. So those would be my three suggestions for you, Marcy. Rachel, what would you suggest?
I think my first suggestion would be Lady Rose and Mrs. Memory by Phoebe Ferguson.
Good idea, yeah.
It's a wonderful novel. It's published, republished by Persephone. And yes, it's just a really beautiful story. And, you know, there is sadness in it, but it's overwhelmingly, I would say, a positive story. And I also love another one of hers, which I've talked about in the podcast before, which is called For Every Favour, which is amazing, but it's very hard to get hold of. So it's not fair of me to recommend that. another option that I would pick, and it might not be everybody's cup of tea, but I find this one a wonderful comfort read, and it's South Riding by Winifred Holtby. You don't like it, I know, but
no.
I absolutely love it. And it's really reminds me of, well, I mean, it doesn't remind me of anything. Actually, no, that's not what I mean. It's one of those books that makes you feel better about the world and the possibility of what we can achieve when people are, people come together. Basically, there's lots of tragedy in the book and bad stuff happens, and it's very realistic in the sense that, you know, life often doesn't turn out very well for a lot of people, but there's still a lot of hope in there. And it's also one of those books that will take you quite a long time to read, and if you really like being immersed in one world for quite a long time, that in itself I think can be quite comforting when you stop for a couple of weeks and you can really be in that world, and you don't have to think of anything outside of it. That for me is just a wonderful read, and if you haven't read it, it's highly recommended despite Simon's dislike.
Yeah, so you can listen to the episode we've done it for why I think it's very boring, but I hope you like it, Marcy.
I think you just missed the point, Simon, but there we are. And I think my third choice, gosh, this is tricky actually. I'm just thinking of something bad happens in that one. I think actually, again, like this book, there is a sort of sadness to it. But one of my most favourite books of all time is called Crossing to Safety by Wallace Stegner. It's an American novel about four friends and their journey through life. And there's a sad reason for why the book starts where it does, but it's such a beautiful story about the power of friendship and love and coping with the disappointment that life often is. And I think it's wonderful, and it's one that I often give to people to read, and people always tell me how much they love it. So there we are.
There you go. Yeah. You mentioned Ruby Ferguson, right? So that I did pick one up in Hay on White last year, which I've not read yet, but Turn Again Home, familiar?
I don't know that one, no.
Yeah, and I don't know how lucky I was to find that or not, but
you could have a little bit.
Yeah, pleased to come across it. Great. Well, Marcy, I hope that helps. And now I guess we must do the decision making. I'm going to say, obviously, the answer is, as always, somewhere between the two. But I think broadly what I'm looking for in literary fiction and what I'm looking for in comfort reads are not likely to be the same. So I'm going to say I lean more towards no on can literary fiction be comfort reads.
I would lean more towards yes on that, because I think that something, I can only read something that's well written.
There we go. Hope that helped. We have a question for the middle, which is from Jo. Thank you, Jo. So she says, I have a question, which is from listening to your episode on 112 on They Were Sisters. I'd forgotten we'd done They Were Sisters. You were mentioning that the book was published 80-odd years ago, but comes across in a very contemporary way of the content and the crafting of the characters. Which other books from the mid or early 20th century stand out most for you in this way?
Oh, gosh. Okay. Well, there was that book that you made me read and I didn't like very much, but you did. And it was about the, it was Ex-Wife.
Are you thinking of One Year's Time, Angela Mayer?
No, I didn't like Ex-Wife. I know I didn't.
Did you not? Oh, sorry. I see the Parrot's Ex-Wife. I mean, I remember, that's one that we did with Lucy Scoyles when she was a guest.
Yeah, and I didn't like it.
Did you not? Gosh, I'd misremembered that. Well, there we go.
But that came across as very modern. But One Year's Time also, yes, well remembered. I did. I love how you just know where my mind is going. 3 years of friendship. And yes, on that one, I think we both said we found that incredibly surprising. Like if it hadn't been in the covers it was in, I would not have guessed it wasn't published yesterday.
Yeah, that was the one that came to my mind first. And I might have said on that episode, but when I was having a discussion with the editor at the British Library, they did say we're not, something that they were a bit unsure of is the book felt too modern to publish as a vintage book. Because yeah, and I think both that one and Ex-Wife, what makes it feel modern is just the frankness about sex and about sex relationships in a way that that we often don't believe was in fiction. Obviously we know it was in life at that time, but you don't expect it to be in fiction of the time.
I think another one like that, I mean there are features in it that date it to its time, but The Group by what's the author,
Mary McCarthy.
Yes. And also there's another similar one in that vein, The Best of Everything by Raina Jaffe, both set in sort of 1950s New York, looking at young girls kind of making their way in the world. Both of them, when I read them, felt very fresh and modern to me. I remember reading them when I was much younger, living in New York myself. And it felt very reflective of the life I was going through, you know, 50, 60 odd years later. So those are also examples.
Yeah, the other one that was in mind is actually the one we did in the Ex-Wife episode, Sally on the Rocks by Winifred Boggs, which is published in the 1910s, and in some ways does feel very of its time. But the thing that really made it stand out, or made it feel modern to me, was that love triangle where the two women who are both vying for this man have so much respect for each other and no respect at all for the man. So it definitely feels surprisingly feminist for a book more than 100 years old. So that one stood out to me as well. It's a good question, Joe. I have to think on that more. And what is it that makes things feel in some ways anachronistic, I guess.
Yeah.
Thank you, Joe. And now on to the books. So it's Enter Ghost by Isabella Hamad and Lady Living Alone, originally published under the name Peter Curtis, but actually by Nora Lofts. Would you rather introduce the one you picture your top 10 or the one you've just read?
I'll do the one I've just read, please.
Great. Well, let's go chronological. You can start off.
Okay, so Lady Living Alone is in the British Library Women Writers series, and it is set, when is it set? 1930s, I feel?
Yes, I think it's, is that right? I think that's right. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's a woman called Penelope Shadow. Her surname gives a clue to the kind of person she is, sort of somebody who's always been on the edges of life, a little bit useless at everything, reliant on other people. She has a real passion for writing, but has never had any great success until she gets to the age of about 35, and she very unexpectedly manages to write a book that becomes a sort of overnight bestseller, and she gets all this money from it. And this is the perfect time then for her sister, who she's been living with all this time, to be able to finally get married and go off to live in Uganda, which is her dream. And Penelope therefore has to find herself somewhere to live. So she buys herself a big old house. But the problem is, Penelope has a fear of being in a house alone after dark, so she cannot live by herself. And she initially, this isn't a problem because she has lots of housekeepers, but she cannot hold on to a servant for love nor money, doesn't know why. And then the kind of main crux of the story happens when it's a Christmas. She's coming home from having stayed with a friend, and she receives a message that her housekeeper has quit and is not coming back. And she has this realization that she will return home to a dark house, and what can she do? So she decides to go to a hotel, a very creepy hotel. And in this hotel, she meets one of the first person she meets is the young man who opens the door. And by the end of her one night of staying there, or a couple of nights of staying there, she ends up employing him to come back to her house and be her housekeeper. And initially, he seems absolutely perfect, a little bit, maybe a little bit too perfect. And that's the, I won't say any more at this point, but their relationship and what happens going forward is the main thrust of the book. So there we are.
Lovely, thank you. And then something very different. Entergoast is set in Palestine. There's a woman called Sonia, who is an actor who has family there, but lives in London, or has lived in London. And she is an actor who has some success, but not massive success. But she's escaped basically because she's been having an affair that she needs to get away from, and she goes to stay with her sister Hanine, who lives in Palestine. Does she live in Palestine? Does she live in Israel? I'm now forgetting.
Lives in Israel. Yeah,
that's right. She lives in Israel, but because they are Arabic Israeli, they're allowed to cross the border sometimes. Is that right? Going to get complex in my head. Sorry, apologies if I get any of this wrong. Anyway, she is invited to take part in an Arabic production of Hamlet that is happening in the West Bank. It's being directed by a woman called Miriam, and she is very keen to get Sonia involved playing Gertrude, Hamlet's mother. And originally, or initially, Sonia is very reluctant to this, and does say eventually that she will do it for a bit whilst they look for a different one. And she gets put in this cast where most notably there is a famous Palestinian pop star who is not particularly good at acting, it seems, but is very got a lot of star quality, and various other people ranging from people who live in a refugee camp through to more professional actors who want to be part of this production. And she does eventually get persuaded to be more permanently part of that production. And it's it uses that production of Hamlet. Obviously, the title Entergoast is from Hamlet, and explores the themes of Hamlet alongside the life in contemporary Palestinians going through Israeli checkpoints between Israel and the West Bank, the sort of threat that to their safety that they feel, and what it's like to be Sonia, who is sort of at home and not at home, as somebody whose actual home is in another country, but who does have roots and family there, particularly going back to a home that had been in their family but was taken away from them.
Okay.
Where to start?
I mean, two books on the surface don't seem to have a lot in common, but, you know, as always, we're very good at finding connections where they appear to be lacking. And I think it's interesting that both of these books are about creative women. Women who are not partnered, women making their own way in the world. And both of them are in a position of danger. And I think it's interesting to think about them from that perspective. I think for me, Lady Living Alone was, it wasn't quite what I expected. I expected it to be a little bit more, I suppose, menacing from the start. But I think what's really interesting about the book is that Penelope is very much seen as a kind of, I suppose, naive woman who has got no idea what's going on around her. And she is very much in that characterization for most of the book. It didn't put me off it at all. I mean, I very much enjoyed it. And I loved the fact that she was this really creative person who had managed to make this life for herself, but she was also very dependent on other people. And I always have a problem with women who are depicted in that way. And I think what's interesting about the book and people's reaction in the book and people's reactions to her relationship with Terry, who is the housekeeper who she quite quickly, I think it's okay to say this because it does happen quite quickly, they do quite quickly get married. Mm. She's very much in love with him and he seems to be very much in love with her. But the issue is, number one, the difference in age. So she's a good 10 plus years older than him. And that's an issue for people. Would that be an issue if the genders were reversed? I don't think so.
And of course not, no.
And that's what makes people think initially, really, that there's a problem. And also the fact that she's his servant. He's her servant. And the idea that that couldn't possibly work as a relationship, and people sort of mentioning to her, this isn't right, he's got too much power over you, he's got too much this concern for you, and that's what prompts them to get married. But it's the idea of an unequal relationship and him being very much this sort of, I guess we would consider it to be a kind of house husband. Yeah. And she's bringing in all the money, and that eventually becomes a problem. Now, what we don't get in the book is much interiority for Terry himself to understand why he makes the choices that he makes. And I think that would have made it a more successful book if we had a kind of equal understanding, because I think an easy reading of the book would be that, you know, he just sees her coming, really, that she's a cash cow and he's got the opportunity to play away and have what he wants, and, you know, she's not really interested in a kind of, you know, she's got her head in the clouds the whole time, so she only sees what she wants to see. And I think that's, yeah, it's interesting because there is that tension, and she does, you know, she does surprise everybody at the end. But I think it's an interesting depiction of a woman and a relationship that's unequal, and her desperation to hold on to him despite knowing what he's like is not a particularly flattering portrayal. And it's just, I don't know, it didn't stop me from enjoying the book, like I say, but it was a book that made me feel uncomfortable, but not in a bad way. So I just thought it was a choice for her to write about a woman like this. I don't know what you thought about it.
Yeah, I think that issue about whether the tone of the novel is really interesting. And again, we won't give too many spoilers, but we will say it's not the sort of funny, lighthearted domestic novel it starts off being, because that tone is, at first, it does feel less like a sort of domestic novel. It's quite, I think it's really funny. I think she's, her sort of helplessness is played a bit for laughs. You don't feel particularly sorry for her. She's just, you know, eccentric and useless, but has this talent that she's hidden and doesn't seem particularly upset by it. And even the foible of her not being able to be in a home living alone is at first treated as a foible. It's not treated as something to take seriously or something that's even particularly debilitating in her life. It is more just like, here's another eccentric detail about her. And the novel gets increasingly menacing as it goes forward, although, as you say, very gradual. And so for that point, I quite like that we don't get Terry's interiority, because you're assessing, is this menacing or is this just her being weird or not weird, odd, I guess. What tone am I meant to be reading? And I think Nora Loss is constantly playing with tone and context in the novel and giving you a different novel to the one you think you're getting. And by contrast, as you say, Sonia also in danger, but everyone's in danger as they travel to and from the West Bank and as they're in the West Bank. And it's not, you know, it's not Gaza, it's not as dangerous, but there's still a very present understanding in the lives of these Arabic Israelis that they are under threat at all times. And what's interesting there, by contrast with, you know, this is one woman in Lady Living Alone who has this fear that no one else really computes, is that here Sonia has this fear that everyone recognizes, but she's different from them because she's lived outside that context for most of her life. And she's coming from a, you know, country of relative safety into a country without relative safety, and is trying to, yeah, both be at home and not at home in that context. And it's not like the novel is all about danger or all about fear, because it is, as you say, all about so much about creativity in it, and about finding ways of normality and beyond that of this extraordinary creativity in a context of fear. But yeah, I think it is really interesting that one is really about menace where you wouldn't expect it, and one is about finding some form of attempts at peace in an area that everyone acknowledges is menacing.
Yeah. It's interesting, isn't it? And I think Exit West, for me, not Exit West, that's a completely different book.
It's a good book though, Exit West.
Enter Ghost is really interesting, what you said there about the experience of going from a country where you don't have to think about your safety to a country where you have to think about it all the time. But everybody else that you're socialising with, that state of living is very normal. And it's the sort of background to their lives and is not something that they necessarily think about all the time. And she finds that frustrating, I guess. And that also opens her up to being, all of them up to being exploited in a way, because there's, you know, well, I won't say too much about that, but, you know, there's that guy who turns out to be not who he says he is, and it causes them huge problems. But I think what's... for me, about Enter Ghost was the thing that, I mean, I love anything that's about the kind of creative process and the building of community through creativity, which is a huge part of what I do as a drama teacher in school and doing plays and stuff with kids. And it's also that thinking of how playing somebody else helps you to work through whatever it is that you're struggling with, and working out who you are. Because I think when you're playing another character and you're really delving into these characters and why they're behaving the way that they are, and you're thinking about motivation, and you're immersed in that, and like they have so many interesting discussions, don't they, in the book about, you know, why does Hamlet do this? And everybody's got a different perspective because everybody's bringing themselves and their experiences to it. And having that ability to work through a play that explores so much of what it is to be human. I mean, it's not my favourite Shakespeare play, but its exploration of grief is so powerful. And, you know, she's going through a period of grief for this relationship that she's come out of, and also the, I guess, grief for the life that she thought she should have by now.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that exploration of how a creative work can help you to process personal pain is brilliant, and that was the part of the book I enjoyed the most. And I suppose for me, that what feels a little bit disappointing about Lady Living Alone is, what is the point in having a character be a novelist if that novelist's life and that writing life and the immersion in another world isn't necessarily at the forefront of the book or really touched on in any part of the book? We don't even really, we have a couple of, there's like that, there's a description of, you know, her night of writing at the hotel where she's, you know, she can't chain smoking, and she's typing away, and it's all just coming out of her. But there's no sense of really what makes her tick as a writer and what she gets from it, other than the fact she, you know, gets to go into a different world for a while.
I think that is fair. I think that is fair, because it does feel just sort of a convenient way of her being wealthy and independent to an extent. I agree with you there. Interestingly, Rowan Mateson wrote a good review of the novel recently on her blog, where she talks about how Penelope's writing really plays into how she acts in the denouement. Again, I won't spoil that, but I hadn't thought about that. And I think the way she went through the different tropes she'd learnt in her writing and then putting them into play in reality was interesting. So there is that angle, because previously I think I would have completely agreed with you, and I did think that whilst reading it, that it's not about a novel about an author, it's about a novel about an independently wealthy woman, and that's why she's an author in the novel. I think that, yeah, did miss an opportunity there perhaps. And then going back to Enter Ghost, I agree. I agree about that idea of looking at how they analyse the motivation of Hamlet's characters and then playing the one they analyse. I think what made it not work completely for me was a mix of, I never really felt like I knew that cast particularly well. in the same. I really felt I knew Sonia and her sister, and that relationship was brilliant, and the different lives they'd lived, and that conflict between them, and the love between them was really done well. But I never fully parceled out who all the different casts were, and that's partly, I think, because I listened to the audiobook, and quite a lot of the novel is set out, I assume, based on the audiobook, like a play. So you get scenes of the rehearsal that are written in play script form, which I'm sure works very well on the page and doesn't really work at all as an audiobook, because if you're having to stop and say the characters' names every time someone says something, it felt very disjointed listening to it as an audiobook. So I would recommend perhaps that people don't listen to this as an audiobook. I think it probably works better as a print book. Yes. How did you find the play script sections? Were they effective when you were reading them?
I mean, to be honest, I didn't really see the point. It felt a little it was a little bit gimmicky. But, you know, it was fine. I could accept it, but I didn't really see that it added anything.
Okay. Well, I didn't miss too much then. I guess my overall feeling from it was this is a good book, but I think the reason it's such a popular book is that people were desperate for any book set in Palestine because they wanted to learn more about that part of the world with all the conflict going on. And I think that just happened to be the book set in Palestine that people turned to. Is that unfair? I don't know. I don't think it was particularly better than any other novel that I've read in recent years. And it's, yeah, the context is what made it contemporarily interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I don't disagree with you, I have to say. I mean, it's an absolutely, it's an interesting book. The setting makes it interesting. What she chooses to explore within that setting is really interesting. And I think I learned a lot from it, and I enjoyed being, you know, taken to a part of the world that I don't often read about. But I did think that it was overlong.
Yes, I think that's true, yeah.
It felt like, yeah, it needed a good editing and a little bit more thinking about what is it that you're really doing with this book.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I also think there are some bits I found, like going through a checkpoint and that sort of thing, described really well. Some of that fear, she was really good at conveying fear and apprehension.
Yes.
I think it's certainly a very subjective book. I don't think somebody who has more sympathies for the state of Israel would find necessarily that it represented what they believe is going on there. But I will say, I mean, a few years ago, I did go to the West Bank and I did go to Jerusalem. I went through the checkpoints, and obviously I was a British tourist who was never really in any danger, but it did bring back a lot of the atmosphere of being there. More what I saw other people going through at checkpoints than what I experienced myself. And I think she did do that well. It helped that I recognised these places that I've been to them. And yeah, I don't know. I can't remember if you've been to that part of the world or not, but I don't know if it came, if you felt like you understood that part of the world without having seen it, or if you have been there.
No, and I think that for me was one of the problems with it as well, is that I found it quite difficult to imagine. I mean, I've been to Jordan, and which, you know, I imagine geographically and architecturally has some similarities, it being a neighbouring country. And I mean, I've seen Jerusalem from across the water, but I've never been there. And so I think for me as well, that was part of my problem with being able to enter into the world. I couldn't imagine what it looked like, and I really struggled with that.
And I think she didn't really bring across the thing that was most glaring, is you go from the wealth and shininess of Jerusalem into the poverty and just absolute opposite of that in the West Bank. And that was, I found so striking, because in some ways Jerusalem feels like a, you know, Western European city in many ways, in this architecture and its bustle, and you're like, this is just a shopping street like I'd recognize from going around any Western European country. And then you go to West Bank, which is so completely different. And I guess we were looking more at her emotional reactions to being in these places than we were about her vision. Because, I mean, it's not a surprise to her what they look like. She knows what they look like. So I guess it wouldn't make sense for her to dwell on it too much. But yeah, I think certainly as a tourist, if the experience of the two countries my experience of those is obviously nothing like Sonia's experience of them. So maybe that doesn't matter. But it did feel if you didn't have the same eyes for those places that Sonia does already, then you might feel a bit at sea placing yourself in her shoes.
Yes, and that's certainly how I felt. And I think that's, it was difficult for me to sort of re-immerse myself in the novel every time I picked it up, because I kept forgetting where each place was, and because I just don't, that geography just isn't in my head. So it was tough for that reason. But that's just my own ignorance and lack of experience, rather than, I think, necessarily the fault of the author.
Whereas, I mean, obviously a very different setting, but I think Nora Loss did well at her domestic settings. I loved the motel setting, because that's not something I've come across that often in a novel. And I think she really got across the sort of griminess of it. It's not like the worst place in the world to stay, but it's clearly down on its luck, and it's, caters to a certain class of person and doesn't really meet anyone's expectations or hopes, but isn't out and out awful. I thought she did that really well. Yeah. And then I guess in some ways it's sort of a updating of the Gothic, where the house that she later lives in, because this idea of not wanting to be alone is a very, in a big house, is obviously a very Gothic sort of idea, but it is updated to the, I think it's published in 1940s, but I think set before the war in 1930s.
I mean, why she didn't just get a housemate, I don't know, but there we are.
Or a paid companion or something. People were still having those, weren't they?
Yeah. Getting some kind of timer put on the lamps. That would have been, you know, all sorts of solutions.
Yeah. Well, well done, Penelope. You did your best. And I mean, I'm really glad we managed to reprint that one, because I've not read anything else by her, but I know she is quite popular still for historical fiction, and I think she does have some really interesting other things that people don't tend to know about.
Mm.
Well, let's make our decision. Which one are you going to go for?
As you know, it's a tough one, because they're both flawed, but both enjoyable in their own way. But I think probably I would stick with my own choice there, which was Enter Ghost, because I think it offered more, offered more intellectually and I think on the creative side of things than Lady Living Alone did. I felt there was too much of a missed opportunity there.
Fair enough. And whilst I think I do agree with you that, you know, it is a more intellectual book, Enter Ghost, I definitely preferred reading Lady Living Alone. I think I just love the tone of it. I think she did such a good job. So I will stick also with my choice for Lady Living Alone. And it would be weird if we didn't really pick books that we chose for our top 10 for last year. Fun. Okay. In the next episode, we will discuss two books with an interestingly similar premise of strangers being invited to an event where the host is not there and they gradually get murdered. It is the plot both of And Then There Were None by Agatha Christie and The Invisible Host by Gwen Bristow and Bruce Manning. And we are grateful to Susan for suggesting that we do that pairing. And if you've got any suggestions, particularly for topics or questions for middle section, do get in touch at tourbooks@gmail.com. And you can find all the books and authors we mentioned at stuckinabook.com. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening, everyone.
Bye.
Thank you.